The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is a trail dog?
A trail dog is a member of a professional trail crew. It's a word that I learned my first season on the trail, where people refer to themselves as that. There are lots of people who do trail work in a volunteer capacity or for a season here or there, and a trail dog is kind of like the membership word, that you've stuck it out long enough to be a real trails laborer who is committed to this particular life.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Shereen Newman talking with Christine Bile about her memoir, Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods. One of your favorite authors, Henry David Thoreau, wrote, quote, "I went to the woods in order to live deliberately," end quote. And you wrote, "I went to the woods in order to earn a paycheck." Explain why you moved west and how you got your first job in the woods.
Well, that complement of quotes you just read perfectly sums up my feelings about Henry David Thoreau, who I do really admire and have learned a lot from. But I also have always had this niggle with him about the practicalities of things that have sometimes been kind of glossed over. And so for me, a really important thing was complicating that wilderness draw with the pragmatic, how do I make a living? And when I moved west, which I moved to Missoula right after college, intending to take a break between college and graduate school, I was pretty set on a track in comparative literature. And then I moved to Missoula, and I wasn't really familiar, being from the Midwest, with this culture of seasonal work. And I was really interested in it. One of the first roommates I had in town was a trail dog. And he said, "Oh, you and my boyfriend at the time, my husband now, Gabe, you guys should work in the park. You'd love it." And he kind of set us up in Glacier with the right person to apply for a trail crew job. And so I did that more or less on a whim, not expecting really to be hired. I had very little in the way of a manual labor resume. But I got on when the laborer was a little desperate. A woman had quit at the last minute, and my boyfriend Gabe at the time had already gone up to the park and was working, and I was set on not having that job and spending a summer in Missoula, which is a fine second choice. And then I got the call, and he said, "You know, if you can be here in, you know, basically 15 minutes, you have a job." And so I packed up everything and up I went.
Wow. And you stuck with it for many years.
I did. Yes. That first season was relatively short. It was about 3.5 months. I started a little late, as I said, but I knew that I loved it. I felt it was unlike anything I'd ever done before. Being in Glacier, learning new skills, the people I worked with were incredibly complex and interesting, far beyond what I would have thought the stereotype of, you know, people who would swing tools all day. I mean, not that I had a diminished view of that, but I definitely came from a background that privileged more the life of the mind, that I was going to go on and be a professor or a thinker or a NPR correspondent or something like that. So it was really, although my dad has worked outdoors and is a laborer to some degree as well, it was a switch for me to really invest in that world and see that those people were fascinating and smart and could teach me things for years.
You learned a lot of new lingo. Mm-hmm. So we've heard trail dog, and your book lays out a list of tools and mm-hmm. what you use them for. But there are some terms like hitch. Mm-hmm. So tell us what that is, and then describe anything that goes along with the hitch that we might not know.
So a hitch is a backcountry stint, work stint in which you live in a camp and go to work daily from that spot. So hitch sites were usually between 5 and 18 miles in from the road. That was kind of the point at which it was not efficient to hike in and out all the way. At that point, you would set up a hitch site, or a gypsy camp, they were called. And to get to our hitch sites, we, in Glacier, were supported by mules. Packers were the cowboys who packed mule strings. Mannies are the cloths that we would wrap the loads in to load onto the mules' pack frames. And then we, you know, had all the associated words that go with living in a backcountry camp. Just, you know, the bear poles and the small cabins usually in some places. In Alaska later, I lived in wall tents now and then. But the words for all kinds of tools, you know, a mattock and a dolmar and just random words. That being a person who was really into language anyway, I entered that world like just delighted that there was a new word every single day. And not just a word, but this whole backstory about it, that it was named for somebody. The Pulaski is named for a Polish firefighter who kind of invented or made it commonly used. And that was fascinating. It was like vocabulary and anthropology and subculture all in one every day in a conversation somewhere.
Yes, every tool had a story, every task had a story behind it. And that comes through in the book. That's what makes it really interesting. You were a woman working what most people would consider to be a man's job. And I'd like you to read a few paragraphs that you wrote about that.
A woman on a trail crew is like a dog in a swimming pool. Even if it can swim, when it jumps in, it gets noticed. The simple fact of showing up for work female announces itself. First, there's the regular sizing up, the kind women are used to in any setting. What's she look like? Is she my type? An unspoken commentary we might be privy to later when we're one of the gang. I've got a hottie on my crew, or have you seen so-and-so in a tank top? Then there's the extra level that happens in labor jobs. Does she seem strong? Will she be a whiner? Can she take a dirty joke? Such taking stock is not a one-way street, of course. Women do it, to men, to each other. But when the new girl enters a trail shop, she isn't rating all the guys. Maybe later, but right then there are too many, and they're watching too close. There's a pressure to the air, an attentiveness, the animal instincts tuned in. Sometimes we're singled out in ways that seem superficially kinder than the meat market perusal. Men will say they like having women on crews because it keeps them honest, makes for better conversation, and because women tend to work smarter, not harder. All of which are often true, and I know the men who say these things mean well. But like any classification that primarily locates someone in opposition to someone else, such kindly analyses can ring annoying to the one being characterized. Like blacks, great rhythm, and gay men, that eye for color, and redheads, boy are they feisty. Fawning stereotypes are as unwelcome as cruel ones, because they build you a box before you get to make your own. Some women respond to stereotype by overswinging, trying to be the crassest, filthiest, most macho, a facade that's unappealing, let's face it, in people, male or female. I have little use for this labor version of the Madonna horror dichotomy, where girls may either be the bodiest of the bunch or the grounded earth mothers who keep the crew clean and modest, but nothing in between. Who among us takes a woods job in order to be the most foul, or worse, a civilizing influence? We don't need men, though, to be aware of gender, and when it's just women, we jostle each other in sorority, all the while at watch. We brush up against each other's body images every day, all of us raised in an appraising world, taught to scrutinize others and ourselves. One woman constantly tends her physical appearance, lip gloss always fresh. Another won't skinny dip at lunch break. One prefers the end of the hike line so no one can look at her butt. We know where we fit. Who eats more, gains least, whose back is injured, who's had knee surgery, some breasts too large for comfortable hiking downhill, some too small to be evident in a baggy t-shirt, the tactful averting of eyes while we peel off sweaty bras at the end of a workday, the rubbing of sunscreen into shoulders and backs. We notice each other's bodies, the beautiful angles and the sweaty reek, the smooth curves and the puckered bulges, and we circle each other in the same dance we know from junior high, from office jobs, from locker rooms, these bodies different only because we are so fully in them. Here's the twist. Those same bodies, so inhabited, provide us the ungendered moments, too, the times when cultural roles and physical parts deconstruct and we become people working side by side. The best times with men and women are those when the moment demands every last thing, and there's no room in the brain, no will in the muscles for the extraneous, who's stronger, nice ass I'd sleep with. We aren't checking each other out, and we even forget to evaluate ourselves, free for moments from awareness and appraisal. Self-consciousness dissipates the longer we know each other, when the initial mysteries of pheromone deepen into the mysteries of personhood. Such moments happen when there are miles to cover in pouring rain, a huge project all but done. They happen while we sweat buckets if a bear's nearby when dinner hits the spot. You can see it in our movements, that easy grace of a child at home in her body without a glance to the stands. Maybe we can release our assumptions and assessments in those moments when the physical world becomes so primary because our human skin has sloughed away. When sweating, moving, grunting, relaxing after it's done, stuffing stomachs or stretching our arms to the sky, we aren't men or women, we're animal. Of course, the sniffing we do later, circling each other, pissing on fence posts, jockeying for position, yearning for contact, that's as animal as it gets, isn't it? But that's sex. Sex is simpler. Beneath the constant specter of gender, the best we can do is pardon one another's small vanities, the missteps and awkwardness that arise when men and women work hard together, few of us altogether comfortable in our own skins, constantly negotiating our places on the spectrum between opposite and same.
So think back to that first season, that season when your male coworkers tried to define and categorize and stereotype you. How did you respond to that?
You know, I think of those burdens as more overarching ones than particular with any one person. Because overall, any one man, I don't recall a lot of harassment or stereotyping. I worked with many really incredibly enlightened or generous men and women, both. But there is a kind of cultural subtext that happens around settings like that, where even if someone individually isn't thinking X, that's kind of it's an assumption that's underneath that you can kind of just pick up on. And women that have worked like that, whether it's in a white collar, male dominated field, a woman engineer came up to me recently and was like, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, it's different. It's a different professional capacity, but that undertone of like having to prove yourself, even if no one asks you to, is always somewhat tangible. And the longer I worked, the more I could just kind of let that roll off of me. And the more I got to know the men in particular, the more I could focus on our individual relationship, which generally didn't confirm that stereotype, as opposed to the more cultural one that felt pervasive but was harder to put your finger on.
I'm recalling the scene from the first time that you met the mule guys.
Yes, I know that scene well. It's emblazoned. It's like such a things where you felt ashamed, you know, you'll never expunge them from the gray matter. Yeah, that was those Packers were. They're incredibly charismatic in the sense that they are real cowboys. And there are a certain degree of that culture visible even in Missoula, but to me, as a Midwestern kid moving out to Montana, that felt more like a trope. And so to have a real relationship with people who knew stock the way I knew other things, you know, words or books or whatever, was really, really cool. But they were personally, in tandem, could be really intimidating.
Yes. Intimidating is the word I'm thinking of, because you arrive and the first, I forget his name, but the first man starts running commentary on,
another girl. New one. And it's a girl and why is her hair so short and she doesn't have the right boots. And it's funny. Since I wrote the book, I have started to think about them as like the Greek chorus of the book. Like they collectively mutter from the sidelines all of these comments on the larger story. And it's funny because they were really different. The three main Packers that I worked with for my six seasons in the park, one, Slim, is the one you're thinking of, who was the black-hatted cowboy who was really cranky and just kind of had the most foul mouth I've ever encountered and let you hear it if you did anything wrong, but also was a bit of a softie once you knew him by the end. But two of the other guys were very kind and generous and quiet and joking, and so that, you know, again, you couldn't lump them all together. But yeah, as a new kid on the team, I definitely felt the sense like those were the guys who you really needed approval from, and you needed them on your team because we really quite literally were relying on them.
Mm-hmm. Right, to bring in your supplies.
Right, yeah.
Food.
Exactly. Stuff you can't live without.
Right. You know, given all that you're going into new territory, literally, and encountering people, the kinds of people that you haven't been associated with before, this brand new experience, you must have come away from that first season with something that brought you back year after year after year.
Yes, I did. And I think it was in part that sense of discovery of something that seemed so much more multifaceted than I had guessed it would be. I thought of it as like, oh, this will be really cool. I love to hike. I've always wanted to check out Glacier. It'll be a great way to make a decent living. I mean, at that point in Missoula, you know, you could get a job for like $6 an hour, or you could go work for the park and make like 15. It was kind of a no-brainer. Whether I liked it or not, that was something to do to make some money. But I really was surprised by how rich the subculture was and how much I was learning that I felt. I mean, I had never had a real relationship with my body that way. I mean, I was a scrappy kid and I played sports and I loved to run and I wasn't like, you know, total bookworm. I'd had a relationship with my mind that I knew I could rely on it to do X, Y, or Z, or get a good job or write a good paper or make a valid point. But to have that discovery of my body and realize I can ask it to do X and then expect it to perform, or if it doesn't, like get there over time with it. That was a striking shift for me to invest that and then feel the return on. It helped me integrate, I think, a person that was more nuanced than just like, here's how you think and here's how you dig a hole. It was kind of the whole package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had to work really hard.
Yeah, those days are definitely some of the most grueling ones I probably will ever experience.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Christine Bile about her memoir, Dirt Work, An Education in the Woods. If you tuned in late, you can listen to what you missed at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. We'll be back after a short break to talk about Christine's Seduction by Chainsaw and find out why her memories of 9/11 are not like most people's. Don't go away. Back to talk a little bit about the format of the book. It's not a totally unusual format, but I don't think I've ever run across a book that was categorized by tools.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just run down the table of contents here.
So the six main chapters in the book are structured with a brief intro on the axe, the rock bar, the chainsaw, the boat, specifically a Boston Whaler, a skid steer, and a shovel. And then each of those tools is paired with a region that I most strongly associate that tool with. So the North Fork in Glacier, Sperry in Glacier, Middle Fork in Glacier, Cordova on Prince William Sound in Alaska, and then the last two chapters set in Denali in the interior of Alaska.
I think I was most surprised by your affection for the chainsaw, about which you wrote, "Like most of the great loves of my life, mountains, fiction, winter, the chainsaw seduced me with equal parts freedom and danger." So explain the seductive charms of the chainsaw.
Well, I have always liked a challenge, so I think that was part of it. I have always been drawn to something that seems like a cool skill that would take some doing to figure out. And chainsaw is just, it's pretty charismatic from the outside. I mean, there's an element of the thrill of like, wow, that's very powerful. And you can also do incredible things with it. You can do a lot of work with very little effort. I mean, mental effort and planning and skill, of course, but the difference between cutting through a tree in the trail with a saw and chopping it out with an axe is incredible, the amount of time it saved. So there's that. And just the long lineage of woods work and how many people have been using saws skillfully from the crosscut through the very newest and lightest chainsaw. That whole lineage really appealed to me. And I think also watching the other crew members use it so competently, I was really drawn to that, the possibility of competence in that arena. And the chainsaw was kind of an obvious one. I mean, because people can kind of fake using a shovel or using an axe. I mean, not for very long. Like, you can tell someone who knows what they're doing with a tool within a minute or two. But the chainsaw seemed like it clearly needed a little bit of practice to get good at it. And I just really like cutting and the physical job of both felling trees for projects and also cutting out piles of windfall and reading the lean and the bind on logs that are down and limbing and bucking. It's all, and firewood. I just love it all. I don't know. I can't. It's like, you know, how can you ever explain who you fall in love with? One of those things where it just was kind of, it's just the right time. And yeah.
Well, you were in the woods on September 11, 2001, and you have some very, very different memories of that event than most people who had access to TVs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a really intense experience. I write about it in a fairly long scene, but just to distill it a little bit, I was out on a hitch with a group of other people. We were building a bridge, and a couple other trail dogs hiked in, and that's pretty frequent if you're in the area and you're on your off days and you're going to go climb a peak and you're going to hike past a hitch site. You bring in the chocolate, you bring in the paper, extra peanut M&Ms, Band-Aids, whatever you think somebody might need. And so it was common to have visitors, but these guys came in and they pulled out the paper, and it was the headlines of the bombings in the Daily Interlake, the Kalispell paper. And at first we thought they were joking. It just seemed so, like, now it's harder to picture. Now, you know, this many years later, where terror and mass murder are a lot more common, I mean, relatively speaking, it's harder to picture why you would think that was a joke. But back then, like, that was really not something you thought could be on the front page of a small town American paper. So there was this nervous sort of, huh, what's, you guys, that's not really very funny. Like, trail dogs are notorious pranksters. So, like, it would be a lot more likely that somebody was pulling a really, really inappropriate joke than that somebody would have attacked on American soil. So that, I guess, I share with everybody, that strange feeling of, like, is this real? Like, is this a War of the Worlds thing? Or is this a kind of a meta narrative of somebody else that we're having the wool pulled over? This can't be real kind of feeling. But after that, once we integrated the reality of the news, it was very surreal to wonder what was going on out there, but be in the woods. And this was way pre-cell phone. Nobody was connected in the way we are now. It was pretty much when you were out, you were out. And then 10 days later, you came out and you knew what happened. And so my memories of that whole week were mental processing and wondering and thinking about what must be going on, but no news, no visuals, no mediated meaning by talking heads. So
you didn't watch the towers like everybody else did fall 500 times in 2 days.
Mm-mm. Yeah. No. And sometimes I miss that, like having that bond with everybody about that historical moment. But other times I'm really glad that I kind of have a lot of space around that time where I got to make my own sense of it without having to be, because you didn't see the towers without hearing everybody commenting on what it was going to be, what it was going to mean, speculative and blaming and pretty quickly retaliatory language. And that, I felt like I kind of got to get a little bit of my own thinking around it first and feeling. That has remained pretty meaningful. I'm glad for that.
Process a little bit on your own.
Mm-hmm. And with the crew. I mean, we talked about it a lot. And when I think back, it's uncanny how many things we kind of had a sense of, maybe. You know, bin Laden had been in the news a bit already as a target before that. I remember an article I had read in Time magazine about Clinton and bin Laden, and even way, way earlier. And I had this idea, like, was it him? Could it have been him? And this was way before any of us ever heard that it was. We were all talking about who would have been, who'd done that? Who would have, why would that have been happening? And a lot of conversations about America's role in the world and different people's sense of what we should or shouldn't be doing. And trail dogs are, I mean, there's a lot of like, you know, the I'm between semesters in a college liberal woodsy person, but there is a bit of diversity. I definitely worked with, you know, Mormon kids and ranch kids from Eastern Montana and guys in their 40s who had left an office job of some kind. So the spectrum of people who and what they thought about the political world was actually diverse enough to make for really interesting synthesis together.
Well, you eventually left work in Glacier and you went to graduate school in Alaska and worked in a couple parks there. And now that's your home. Mm-hmm. And as you were at the end of your trail dog career, as you were like the wise woman and you had younger women coming in, how did that feel? How did that transition sit with you?
It felt like a really great bookend because I entered the trails world under the tutelage of women, even though it was a male world dominantly. My first leader was a woman, and I worked on a crew for almost all my time in Glacier with at least one other woman, sometimes only women. And then my Denali and Cordova years were much more male. Alaska's work world is very, still very male dominated. So those memories of passing on the baton, they feel really rich. They feel like that lineage that I was attracted to early on, that I became a part of it. And I still have that. I mean, I don't work on a crew anymore, but my husband and I own our own small business doing trail work all over Alaska. So we do a lot of design, construction, consulting, and training. And just this past summer, I was on a project where we were building a bridge in Anchorage, in a city park, and we had a youth crew for a week or so, and there were four girls who were under 18, and I just had really great times with them, teaching them what's the difference between a bolt, a nail, and a screw, and how do you change the battery on a cordless tool, and what's the best way to use a shovel if you're going to move gravel? How can you do it for 3 hours instead of be tired? And those were really great, and I actually got a letter from one of the girls at the later on who was like, I think I want to do this. Like and I mean, you know, it doesn't need to be about whether somebody actually chooses that in the end or not, but getting to be someone who is taking the skills that I was given and get to give them to another woman upcoming who senses an empowerment in that is really, really meaningful. And I love the connection to just all the different people over years who have made a life using their hands. And yeah, it's pretty great to feel like I'm a part of that.
Christine Bile lives with her husband and some sled dogs off the grid near the town of Healy, Alaska. Look for more information about her, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page, at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.